Cassette 1, side 2.
A second man came up, spitting oaths at us. What have you come here for, you sons of bitches? What are you doing here, huh? Someone dared to answer him.
What do you think? Do you suppose we've come here for our own pleasure? Do you think we asked to come?
A little more and the man would have killed him.
You shut your trap, you filthy swine, or I'll squash you right now. You'd have done better to have hanged yourselves where you were than come here. Didn't you know what was in store for you at Auschwitz? Haven't you heard about it in 1944?
No, we had not heard. No one had told us. He could not believe his ears. His tone of voice became increasingly brutal.
Do you see that chimney over there? See it? Do you see those flames?
Yes, we did see the flames.
Over there, that's where you're going to be taken. That's your grave over there. Haven't you realized it yet? You dumb bastards. Don't you understand anything? You're going to be burned, frizzled away, turned into ashes.
He was growing hysterical in his fury. We stayed motionless, petrified. Surely it was all a nightmare, an unimaginable nightmare. I heard murmurs around me. We've got to do something. We can't let ourselves be killed. We can't go like beasts to the slaughter. We've got to revolt. There were a few sturdy young fellows among us. They had knives on them, and they tried to incite the others to throw themselves on the armed guards. One of the young men cried, "Let the world learn of the existence of Auschwitz. Let everybody hear about it while they can still escape." But the older ones begged their children not to do anything foolish. "You must never lose faith, even when the sword hangs over your head. That's the teaching of our sages." The wind of revolt died down. We continued our march toward the square. In the middle stood the notorious Dr. Mengele, a typical SS officer, a cruel face but not devoid of intelligence, and wearing a monocle. A conductor's baton in his hand, he was standing among the other officers. The baton moved unremittingly, sometimes to the right, sometimes to the left. I was already in front of him. "How old are you?" he asked, in an attempt at a paternal tone of voice.
18.
My voice was shaking.
"Are you in good health?"
"Yes."
"What's your occupation?"
Should I say that I was a student? "Farmer," I heard myself say. This conversation cannot have lasted more than a few seconds. It had seemed like an eternity to me. The baton moved to the left. I took half a step forward. I wanted to see first where they were sending my father. If he went to the right, I would go after him. The baton once again pointed to the left for him, too. A weight was lifted from my heart. We did not yet know which was the better side, right or left, which road led to prison and which to the crematory. But for the moment I was happy. I was near my father. Our procession continued to move slowly forward. Another prisoner came up to us.
"Satisfied?"
"Yes," someone replied.
"Poor devils, you're going to the crematory."
He seemed to be telling the truth. Not far from us, flames were leaping up from a ditch, gigantic flames. They were burning something. A lorry drew up at the pit and delivered its load. Little children. Babies. Yes, I saw it. Saw it with my own eyes. Those children in the flames. Is it surprising that I could not sleep after that? Sleep had fled from my eyes. So this was where we were going. A little farther on was another and larger ditch for adults. I pinched my face. Was I still alive? Was I awake? I could not believe it. How could it be possible for them to burn people, children, and for the world to keep silent? No, none of this could be true. It was a nightmare. Soon I should wake with a start, my heart pounding, and find myself back in the bedroom of my childhood among my books. My father's voice drew me from my thoughts. "It's a shame. A shame that you couldn't have gone with your mother. I saw several boys of your age going with their mothers." His voice was terribly sad. I realized that he did not want to see what they were going to do to me. He did not want to see the burning of his only son. My forehead was bathed in cold sweat, but I told him that I did not believe that they could burn people in our age, that humanity would never tolerate it. Humanity. Humanity is not concerned with us. Today, anything is allowed. Anything is possible, even these crematories. His voice was choking. Father, I said, if that is so, I don't want to wait here. I'm going to run to the electric wire. That would be better than slow agony in the flames. He did not answer. He was weeping. His body was shaking convulsively. Around us, everyone was weeping. Someone began to recite the Kaddish, the prayer for the dead. I do not know if it has ever happened before in the long history of the Jews that people have ever recited the prayer for the dead for themselves. Yitkadal v'yitkadash Shimei Rabbah. May his name be blessed and magnified, whispered my father. For the first time, I felt revolt rise up in me. Why should I bless his name? The eternal Lord of the universe, the all-powerful and terrible, was silent. What had I to thank him for? We continued our march. We were gradually drawing closer to the ditch from which an infernal heat was rising, still 20 steps to go. If I wanted to bring about my own death, this was the moment. Our line had now only 15 paces to cover. I bit my lips so that my father would not hear my teeth chattering. 10 steps still. 8, 7. We marched slowly on as though following a hearse at our own funeral. 4 steps more. 3 steps. There it was now, right in front of us, the pit and its flames. I gathered all that was left of my strength so that I could break from the ranks and throw myself upon the barbed wire. In the depths of my heart, I bid farewell to my father, to the whole universe. And in spite of myself, the words formed themselves and issued in a whisper from my lips, Yitkadal v'yitkadash Shemei Rabbah. May his name be blessed and magnified. My heart was bursting. The moment had come. I was face to face with the angel of death. No. 2 steps from the pit, we were ordered to turn to the left and made to go into a barracks. I pressed my father's hand. He said, Do you remember Madame Schechter in the train? Never shall I forget that night. The first night in camp, which has turned my life into one long night, 7 times cursed and 7 times sealed. Never shall I forget that smoke. Never shall I forget the little faces of the children whose bodies I saw turned into wreaths of smoke beneath a silent blue sky. Never shall I forget those flames which consumed my faith forever. Never shall I forget that nocturnal silence which deprived me for all eternity of the desire to live. Never shall I forget those moments which murdered my God and my soul and turned my dreams to dust. Never shall I forget these things, even if I am condemned to live as long as God himself. Never. The barracks we had been made to go into was very long. In the roof were some blue-tinged skylights. The antechamber of hell must look like this. So many crazed men, so many cries, so much bestial brutality. There were dozens of prisoners to receive us, truncheons in their hands, striking out anywhere, at anyone, without reason. Orders, strip, fast, los, keep only your belts and shoes in your hands. We had to throw our clothes at one end of the barracks. There was already a great heap there, new suits and old. Torn coats, rags. For us, this was the true equality. Nakedness. Shivering with the cold. Some SS officers moved about in the room looking for strong men. If they were so keen on strength, perhaps one should try and pass oneself off as sturdy. My father thought the reverse. It was better not to draw attention to oneself. Our fate would then be the same as the others. Later, we were to learn that he was right. Those who were selected that day were enlisted in the Sonderkommando, the unit which worked in the crematories. Bela Katz, son of a big tradesman from our town, had arrived at Birkenau with the first transport a week before us. When he heard of our arrival, he managed to get word to us that, having been chosen for his strength, he had himself put his father's body into the crematory oven. Blows continued to rain down. To the barber! Belt and shoes in hand, I let myself be dragged off to the barber's. They took our hair off with clippers and shaved off all the hair on our bodies. The same thought buzzed all the time in my head, not to be separated from my father. Freed from the hands of the barbers, we began to wander in the crowd, meeting friends and acquaintances. These meetings filled us with joy. Yes, joy. Thank God you're still alive. But others were crying. They used all their remaining strength in weeping. Why had they let themselves be brought here? Why couldn't they have died in their beds? Sobs choked their voices. Suddenly, someone threw his arms round my neck in an embrace. Yechiel, brother of the rabbi of Siget. He was sobbing bitterly. I thought he was weeping with joy at still being alive. "Don't cry, Yechiel," I said. "Don't waste your tears." "Not cry? We're on the threshold of death. Soon we shall have crossed over. Don't you understand? How could I not cry?" Through the blue-tinged skylights, I could see the darkness gradually fading. I had ceased to feel fear. And then I was overcome by an inhuman weariness. Those absent no longer touched even the surface of our memories. We still spoke of them. Who knows what may have become of them, but we had little concern for their fate. We were incapable of thinking of anything at all. Our senses were blunted. Everything was blurred as in a fog. It was no longer possible to grasp anything. The instincts of self-preservation, of self-defense, of pride, had all deserted us. In one ultimate moment of lucidity, it seemed to me that we were damned souls wandering in the half-world, souls condemned to wander through space till the generations of man came to an end, seeking their redemption, seeking oblivion, without hope of finding it. Toward 5 o'clock in the morning, we were driven out of the barracks. The capos beat us once more, but I had ceased to feel any pain from their blows. An icy wind enveloped us. We were naked, our shoes and belts in our hands. The command, "Run!" And we ran. After a few minutes of racing, a new barracks. A barrel of petrol at the entrance, disinfection. Everyone was soaked in it. Then a hot shower at high speed. As we came out from the water, we were driven outside. More running, another barracks, the store. Very long tables, mountains of prison clothes. On we ran. As we passed, trousers, tunic, shirt, and socks were thrown to us. Within a few seconds, we had ceased to be men. If the situation had not been tragic, we should have roared with laughter. Such outfits. Mayor Katz, a giant, had a child's trousers. And Stern, a thin little chap, a tunic which completely swamped him. We immediately began the necessary exchanges. I glanced at my father. How he had changed. His eyes had grown dim. I would have liked to speak to him, but I did not know what to say. The night was gone. The morning star was shining in the sky. I, too, had become a completely different person. The student of the Talmud, the child that I was, had been consumed in the flames. There remained only a shape that looked like me. A dark flame had entered into my soul and devoured it. So much had happened within such a few hours that I had lost all sense of time. When had we left our houses and the ghetto and the train? Was it only a week? One night. One single night. How long had we been standing like this in the icy wind? An hour? Simply an hour? 60 minutes? Surely it was a dream. Not far from us there were some prisoners at work. Some were digging holes, others carrying sand. None of them so much as glanced at us. we were so many dried-up trees in the heart of a desert. Behind me, some people were talking. I had not the slightest desire to listen to what they were saying, to know who was talking or what they were talking about. No one dared to raise his voice, though there was no supervisor near us. People whispered. Perhaps it was because of the thick smoke, which poisoned the air and took one by the throat. We were made to go into a new barracks, in the gypsies' camp, in ranks of five. "And now stay where you are." There was no floor, a roof and four walls. Our feet sank into the mud. Another spell of waiting began. I went to sleep standing up. I dreamed of a bed, of my mother's caress. And I woke up. I was standing, my feet in the mud. Some people collapsed and lay where they were. Others cried, "Are you mad? We've been told to stay standing. Do you want to bring trouble on us all?" As if all the trouble in the world had not descended already upon our heads. Gradually we all sat down in the mud. But we had to jump up constantly, every time a capo came in to see if anybody had a pair of new shoes. If so, they had to be given up to him. It was no use opposing this. Blows rained down, and in the final reckoning, you had lost your shoes anyway. I had new shoes myself, but as they were coated with a thick layer of mud, no one had noticed them. I thanked God in an improvised prayer for having created mud in his infinite and wonderful universe. Suddenly, the silence grew oppressive. An SS officer had come in, and with him, the odor of the Angel of Death. We stared fixedly at his fleshy lips. From the middle of the barracks, he harangued us. "You're in a concentration camp at Auschwitz." A pause. He observed the effect his words had produced. His face has stayed in my memory to this day. A tall man, about 30, with crime inscribed upon his brow and in the pupils of his eyes. He looked us over as if we were a pack of leprous dogs hanging onto our lives. "Remember this," he went on. "Remember it forever. Engrave it into your minds. You are at Auschwitz. And Auschwitz is not a convalescent home. It's a concentration camp. Here you have got to work. If not, you will go straight to the furnace, to the crematory. Work or the crematory. The choice is in your hands." We had already lived through so much that night. We thought nothing could frighten us any more. But his clipped words made us tremble. Here, the word furnace was not a word empty of meaning. It floated on the air, mingling with the smoke. It was perhaps the only word which did have any real meaning here. He left the barracks. Capos appeared, crying. "All skilled workers, locksmiths, electricians, watchmakers, one step forward." The rest of us were made to go to another barracks, a stone one this time, with permission to sit down. A gypsy deportee was in charge of us. My father was suddenly seized with colic. He got up and went toward the gypsy, asking politely in German, "Excuse me, can you tell me where the lavatories are?" The gypsy looked him up and down slowly from head to foot, as if he wanted to convince himself that this man addressing him was really a creature of flesh and bone, a living being with a body and a belly. Then, as if he had suddenly woken up from a heavy doze, he dealt my father such a clout that he fell to the ground, crawling back to his place on all fours. I did not move. What had happened to me? My father had just been struck before my very eyes, and I had not flickered an eyelid. I had looked on and said nothing. Yesterday I should have sunk my nails into the criminal's flesh. Had I changed so much then, so quickly? Now remorse began to gnaw at me. I thought only, I shall never forgive them for that. My father must have guessed my feelings. He whispered in my ear, "It doesn't hurt." His cheek still bore the red mark of the man's hand. "Everyone outside. 10 gypsies had come and joined our supervisor. Whips and truncheons cracked round me. My feet were running without my being aware of it. I tried to hide from the blows behind the others. The spring sunshine. Form fives. The prisoners whom I had noticed in the morning were working at the side. There was no guard near them, only the shadow of the chimney. Dazed by the sunshine and by my reverie, I felt someone tugging at my sleeve. It was my father. Come on, my boy. We marched on. Doors opened and closed again. On we went between the electric wires. At each step, a white placard with a death's head on it stared us in the face. A caption, "Warning, danger of death." Mockery. Was there a single place here where you were not in danger of death? The gypsies stopped near another barracks. They were replaced by SS who surrounded us. Revolvers, machine guns, police dogs. The march had lasted half an hour. Looking around me, I noticed that the barbed wires were behind us. We had left the camp. It was a beautiful April day. The fragrance of spring was in the air. The sun was setting in the west. But we had been marching for only a few moments when we saw the barbed wire of another camp. An iron door with this inscription over it. Work is liberty. Auschwitz. First impression, this was better than Birkenau. There were two-storied buildings of concrete instead of wooden barracks. There were little gardens here and there. We were led to one of these prison blocks. Seated on the ground by the entrance, we began another session of waiting. Every now and then someone was made to go in. These were the showers, a compulsory formality at the entrance to all these camps. Even if you were simply passing from one to the other several times a day, you still had to go through the baths every time. After coming out from the hot water, we stayed shivering in the night air. Our clothes had been left behind in the other block, and we had been promised other outfits. Toward midnight, we were told to run. "Faster!" shouted our guards. "The faster you run, the sooner you can go to bed." After a few minutes of this mad race, we arrived in front of another block. The prisoner in charge was waiting for us. He was a young Pole who smiled at us. He began to talk to us, and despite our weariness, we listened patiently. "Comrades, you're in the concentration camp of Auschwitz. There's a long road of suffering ahead of you, but don't lose courage. You've already escaped the gravest danger, selection. So now muster your strength and don't lose heart. We shall all see the day of liberation. Have faith in life. Above all else, have faith. Drive out despair and you will keep death away from yourselves. Hell is not for eternity. And now, a prayer, or rather a piece of advice. Let there be comradeship among you. We are all brothers, and we are all suffering the same fate. The same smoke floats over all our heads. Help one another. It is the only way to survive." "Enough said. You're tired. Listen, you're in Block 17. I am responsible for keeping order here. Anyone with a complaint against anyone else can come and see me. That's all. You can go to bed. Two people to a bunk. Good night." The first human words. No sooner had we climbed into the bunks than we fell into a deep sleep. The next morning, the veteran prisoners treated us without brutality. We went to the wash place. We were given new clothes. We were brought black coffee. We left the block at about 10 o'clock so that it could be cleaned. Outside, the sunshine warmed us. Our morale was much improved. We were feeling the benefit of a night's sleep. Friends met each other, exchanged a few sentences. We talked of everything except those who had disappeared. The general opinion was that the war was about to end. At about noon, they brought us soup, a plate of thick soup for each person. Tormented though I was by hunger, I refused to touch it. I was still the spoiled child I had always been. My father swallowed my ration. In the shade of the block, we then had a little siesta. He must have been lying, that SS officer in the muddy barracks. Auschwitz was, in fact, a rest home. In the afternoon, we were made to line up. Three prisoners brought a table and some medical instruments. With a left sleeve rolled up, each person passed in front of the table. The three veterans, with needles in their hands, engraved a number on our left arms. I became A7713. After that, I had no other name. At dusk, roll call. The working units came back. Near the door, the band was playing military marches. Tens of thousands of prisoners stood in rows while the SS checked their numbers. After roll call, the prisoners from all the blocks scattered to look for friends, relatives, and neighbors who had arrived in the last convoy. Days passed. In the morning, black coffee. At noon, soup. By the third day, I was eating any kind of soup hungrily. At 6 p.m., roll call. Then bread and something. At 9 o'clock, bed. We had already been 8 days at Auschwitz. It was during roll call. We were not expecting anything except the sound of the bell which would announce the end of roll call. I suddenly heard someone passing between the rows asking, "Which of you is Wiesel of Siget?" The man looking for us was a bespectacled little fellow with a wrinkled, wizened face. My father answered him, "I'm Wiesel of Siget." The little man looked at him for a long while with his eyes narrowed. "You don't recognize me. You don't recognize me. I'm a relative of yours, Stein. Have you forgotten me already? Stein, Stein of Antwerp. Rezel's husband. Your wife was Rezel's aunt. She often used to write to us, and such letters." My father had not recognized him. He must scarcely have known him, since my father was always up to his neck in the affairs of the Jewish community, and much less well-versed in family matters. He was always elsewhere, lost in his thoughts. Once a cousin came to see us at Siget. She had been staying with us and eating at our table for over a fortnight before my father noticed her presence for the first time. No, he could not have remembered Stein. As for me, I recognized him at once. I had known his wife, Rezel, before she left for Belgium. He said, "I was deported in 1942. I heard that a transport had come in from your region, and I came to find you. I thought perhaps you might have news of Rezel and my little boys. They stayed behind in Antwerp." I knew nothing about them. Since 1940, my mother had not had a single letter from them. But I lied. "Yes, my mother's had news from your family. Rezel is very well, the children, too." He wept with joy. He would have liked to stay longer, to learn more details, to drink in the good news, but an SS came up and he had to go, calling to us that he would be back the next day. The bell gave us the signal to disperse. We went to get our evening meal of bread and margarine. I was dreadfully hungry and swallowed my ration on the spot. My father said, "You don't want to eat it all at once. Tomorrow's another day." And seeing that his advice had come too late and that there was nothing left of my ration, he did not even begin his own. "Personally, I'm not hungry," he said. We stayed at Auschwitz for 3 weeks. We had nothing to do. We slept a great deal in the afternoon and at night. The only worry was to avoid moves, to stay here as long as possible. It was not difficult. It was simply a matter of never putting oneself down as a skilled worker. Laborers were being kept till the end. At the beginning of the third week, the prisoner in charge of our block was deprived of his office, being considered too humane. Our new head was savage, and his assistants were real monsters. The good days were over. We began to wonder if it would not be better to let oneself be chosen for the next move. Stein, our relation from Antwerp, continued to visit us, and from time to time he would bring a half ration of bread. "Here, this is for you, Eliezer." Every time he came, there would be tears running down his face, congealing there, freezing. He would often say to my father, "Take care of your son. He's very weak and dried up. Look after him well to avoid the selection. Eat. It doesn't matter what or when. Eat everything you can. The weak don't hang about for long here." And he was so thin himself, so dried up, so weak. "The only thing that keeps me alive," he used to say, "is that Rezel and the children are still alive. If it wasn't for them, I couldn't keep going." He came toward us one evening, his face radiant.
A transport's just come in from Antwerp. I'm going to see them tomorrow. They'll be sure to have news. He went off. We were not to see him again. He had had news. Real news. In the evening, lying on our beds, we would try to sing some of the Hasidic melodies, and Akiba Drummer would break our hearts with his deep, solemn voice. Some talked of God, of his mysterious ways, of the sins of the Jewish people and of their future deliverance. But I had ceased to pray. How I sympathized with Job. I did not deny God's existence, but I doubted his absolute justice. Akiba Drummer said, God is testing us. He wants to find out whether we can dominate our base instincts and kill the Satan within us. We have no right to despair, and if he punishes us relentlessly, it's a sign that he loves us all the more. Hirsch Genud, well-versed in the Kabbalah, spoke of the end of the world and the coming of Messiah. Only occasionally during these conversations did the thought occur to me, where is my mother at this moment, and Sipporah? Your mother is still a young woman, said my father on one occasion. She must be in a labor camp. And Sipporah's a big girl now, isn't she? She must be in a camp, too. How we should have liked to believe it. We pretended, for what if the other one should still be believing it? All the skilled workers had already been sent to other camps. There were only about 100 of us ordinary laborers left. It's your turn today, said the secretary of the block. You're going with the next transport. At 10 o'clock, we were given our daily ration of bread. We were surrounded by about 10 SS. On the door, the plaque, Work is Liberty. We were counted, and then there we were, right out in the country on the sunny road. In the sky, a few little white clouds. We walked slowly. The guards were in no hurry. We were glad of this. As we went through the villages, many of the Germans stared at us without surprise. They had probably already seen quite a few of these processions. On the way, we met some young German girls. The guards began to tease them. The girls giggled, pleased. They let themselves be kissed and tickled, exploding with laughter. They were all laughing and joking and shouting blandishments at one another for a good part of the way. During this time, at least we did not have to endure either shouts or blows from the rifle butt. At the end of 4 hours, we reached our new camp, Buna. The iron gate closed behind us. The camp looked as though it had suffered an epidemic, empty and dead. There were just a few well-clad prisoners walking about between the blocks. Of course, we had to go through the showers first. The head of our camp joined us there. He was a strong, well-built, broad-shouldered man, bull neck, thick lips, frizzled hair. He looked kind. A smile shone from time to time in his gray-blue eyes. Our convoy included a few children, 10 and 12 years old. The officer took an interest in them and gave orders for them to be brought food. After we had been given new clothes, we were installed in 2 tents. We had to wait to be enlisted in the labor units, then we could pass into the block. That evening, the labor units came back from the workyards. Roll call. We began to look for familiar faces, to seek information, to question the veteran prisoners about which labor unit was the best, which block one should try to get into. The prisoners all agreed, saying, Buna's a very good camp. You can stand it. The important thing is not to get transferred to the building unit. As if the choice were in our own hands. The head of our tent was a German, an assassin's face, fleshy lips, hands like a wolf's paws. He was so fat he could hardly move. Like the leader of the camp, he loved children. As soon as we arrived, he had brought them bread, soup, and margarine. Actually, this was not disinterested affection. There was a considerable traffic in children among homosexuals here, I learned later. The head told us, you're staying here 3 days in quarantine, then you're going to work. Tomorrow, medical inspection. One of his assistants, a hard-faced boy with hooligan's eyes, came up to me. Do you want to get into a good unit?
I certainly do, but on one condition. I want to stay with my father. All right, he said. I can arrange that. For a small consideration, your shoes. I'll give you some others. I refused to give him my shoes. They were all I had left. I'll give you an extra ration of bread and margarine. He was very keen on my shoes. But I did not give them up to him. Later on, they were taken from me just the same, but in exchange for nothing this time. Medical examination in the open air in the early hours of the morning before three doctors seated on a bench. The first barely examined me at all. He was content merely to ask, "Are you in good health?" Who would have dared say anything to the contrary? The dentist, on the other hand, seemed most conscientious. He would order us to open our mouths wide. Actually, he was not looking for decayed teeth, but gold ones. Anyone who had gold in his mouth had his number added to a list. I myself had a gold crown. The first 3 days passed by rapidly. On the fourth day, at dawn, when we were standing in front of the tent, the capos appeared. Then each began to choose the men who suited him. "You, you, you and you." They pointed a finger as though choosing cattle or merchandise. We followed our capo, a young man. He made us stop at the entrance to the first block near the door of the camp. This was the orchestra block. "Go in," he ordered. We were surprised. What had we to do with music? The band played a military march, always the same one. Dozens of units left for the workyards in step. The capos beat time. "Left, right, left, right." Some SS officers, pen and paper in hand, counted the men as they went out. The band went on playing the same march until the last unit had gone by. Then the conductor's baton was still. The band stopped dead, and the capos yelled, "Form fives!" We left the camp without music, but in step. We still had the sound of the march in our ears. Left, right, left, right. We started talking to the musicians next to us. We drew up in ranks of five with the musicians. They were nearly all Jews. Yuliek, a bespectacled Pole with a cynical smile on his pale face. Louis, a distinguished violinist who came from Holland. He complained that they would not let him play Beethoven. Jews were not allowed to play German music. Hans, a lively young Berliner. The foreman was a Pole, Franek, a former student from Warsaw. Yuliek explained to me, "We work in a warehouse for electrical equipment not far from here. The work isn't in the least difficult or dangerous. But Yuliek, the capo, has bouts of madness now and then when it's best to keep out of his way." "You're lucky, son," smiled Hans. "You've landed in a good unit." 10 minutes later, we were in front of the warehouse. A German employee, a civilian, the Meister, came to meet us. He paid us about as much attention as a dealer might who was just receiving a delivery of old rags. Our comrades had been right. The work was not difficult. Sitting on the ground, we had to count bolts, bulbs, and small electrical fittings. The capo explained to us at great length the vast importance of our work, warning us that anyone found slacking would have him to reckon with. My new comrades reassured me. "There's nothing to be scared of. He has to say that because of the Meister." There were a number of Polish civilians there and a few French women who were casting friendly glances at the musicians. Franek, the foreman, put me in a corner. "Don't kill yourself, there's no hurry. But mind an SS man doesn't catch you unawares." "Please, I would have liked to be by my father." "All right, your father will be working here by your side." We were lucky. There were two boys attached to our group, Yossi and Tibi, two brothers. They were Czechs whose parents had been exterminated at Birkenau. They lived body and soul for each other. They and I very soon became friends. Having once belonged to a Zionist youth organization, they knew innumerable Hebrew chants. Thus, we would often hum tunes evoking the calm waters of Jordan and the majestic sanctity of Jerusalem. And we would often talk of Palestine. Their parents, like mine, had lacked the courage to wind up their affairs and emigrate while there was still time. We decided that if we were granted our lives until the liberation, we would not stay in Europe a day longer. We would take the first boat for Haifa. Still lost in his Kabbalistic dreams, Akiba Drummer had discovered a verse in the Bible which, interpreted in terms of numerology, enabled him to predict that the deliverance was due within the coming weeks. We had left the tents for the musicians' block. We were entitled to a blanket, a washbowl, and a bar of soap. The head of the block was a German Jew. It was good to be under a Jew. He was called Alphonse, a young man with an extraordinarily aged face. He was entirely devoted to the cause of his block. Whenever he could, he would organize a cauldron of soup for the young ones, the weak, all those who were dreaming more about an extra plateful than of liberty. One day when we had just come back from the warehouse, I was sent for by the secretary of the block. A7713? That's me. After eating, you're to go to the dentist. But I haven't got toothache. After eating, without fail. I went to the hospital block. There were about 20 prisoners waiting in a queue in front of the door. It did not take long to discover why we had been summoned. It was for the extraction of our gold teeth. The dentist, a Jew from Czechoslovakia, had a face like a death mask. When he opened his mouth, there was a horrible sight of yellow, decaying teeth. I sat in the chair and asked him humbly, "Please, what are you going to do?" "Simply take out your gold crown," he replied indifferently. I had the idea of pretending to be ill. "You couldn't wait a few days, doctor. I don't feel very well. I've got a temperature." He wrinkled his brow, thought for a moment, and took my pulse. "All right, son, when you feel better, come back and see me. But don't wait till I send for you." I went to see him a week later, with the same excuse. I still did not feel any better. He did not seem to show any surprise, and I do not know if he believed me. He was probably glad to see that I had come back of my own accord, as I had promised. He gave me another reprieve. A few days after this visit of mine, they closed the dentist's surgery, and he was thrown into prison. He was going to be hanged. It was alleged that he had been running a private traffic of his own in the prisoner's gold teeth. I did not feel any pity for him. I was even pleased about what had happened. I had saved my gold crown. It might be useful to me one day to buy something, bread or life. I now took little interest in anything except my daily plate of soup and my crust of stale bread. Bread, soup. These were my whole life. I was a body. Perhaps less than that even, a starved stomach. The stomach alone was aware of the passage of time. At the warehouse, I often worked next to a young French girl. We did not speak to one another, since she knew no German and I did not understand French. She seemed to me to be a Jewess, though here she passed as Aryan. She was a forced labor deportee. One day when Idek was seized with one of his fits of frenzy, I got in his way. He leaped on me like a wild animal, hitting me in the chest, on the head, throwing me down and pulling me up again, his blows growing more and more violent until I was covered with blood. As I was biting my lips to stop myself from screaming with pain, he must have taken my silence for defiance, for he went on hitting me even harder. Suddenly he calmed down. As if nothing had happened, he sent me back to work. It was as though we had been taking part together in some game where we each had a role to play. I dragged myself to my corner. I ached all over. I felt a cool hand wiping my blood-stained forehead. It was the French girl. She gave me her mournful smile and slipped a bit of bread into my hand. She looked into my eyes. I felt that she wanted to say something but was choked by fear. For a long moment she stayed like that. Then her face cleared and she said to me in almost perfect German, "Bite your lip, little brother. Don't cry. Keep your anger and hatred for another day, for later on. The day will come, but not now. Wait. Grit your teeth and wait." Many years later, in Paris, I was reading my paper in the metro. Facing me was a very beautiful woman with black hair and dreamy eyes. I had seen those eyes before somewhere. It was she. You don't recognize me? I don't know you. In 1944, you were in Germany at Buna, weren't you? Yes. You used to work in the electrical warehouse. Yes, she said, somewhat disturbed. And then, after a moment's silence, wait a minute. I do remember. Idek the capo, the little Jewish boy, your kind words. We left the metro together to sit down on the terrace of a cafe. We spent the whole evening reminiscing. Before I parted from her, I asked her, may I ask you a question? I know what it will be. Go on. What? Am I Jewish? Yes, I am Jewish. From a religious family. During the occupation, I obtained forged papers and passed myself off as an Aryan. That's how I was enlisted in the forced labor camps, and when I was deported to Germany, I escaped the concentration camp. At the warehouse, no one knew I could speak German. That would have aroused suspicions. Saying those few words to you was risky, but I knew you wouldn't give me away. Another time we had to load diesel engines onto trains supervised by German soldiers. Idek's nerves were on edge. He was restraining himself with great difficulty. Suddenly his frenzy broke out. The victim was my father. You lazy old devil, Idek began to yell. Do you call that work? And he began to beat him with an iron bar. At first my father crouched under the blows, then he broke in two, like a dry tree struck by lightning, and collapsed. I had watched the whole scene without moving. I kept quiet. In fact, I was thinking of how to get farther away so that I would not be hit myself. What is more, any anger I felt at that moment was directed not against the capo, but against my father. I was angry with him for not knowing how to avoid Idek's outbreak. That is what concentration camp life had made of me. Franek, the foreman, one day noticed the gold crown tooth in my mouth. Give me your crown, kid. I told him it was impossible that I could not eat without it. What do they give you to eat anyway? I found another answer. The crown had been put down on a list after the medical inspection. This could bring trouble on us both. If you don't give me your crown, you'll pay for it even more. This sympathetic, intelligent youth was suddenly no longer the same person. His eyes gleamed with desire. I told him I had to ask my father's advice. Ask your father, kid, but I want an answer by tomorrow. When I spoke to my father about it, he turned pale, was silent a long while, and then said, No, son, you mustn't do it. He'll take it out on us. He won't dare. But alas, Franek knew where to touch me. He knew my weak point. My father had never done military service, and he never succeeded in marching in step. Here, every time we moved from one place to another in a body, we marched in strict rhythm. This was Franek's chance to torment my father and to thrash him savagely every day. Left, right, punch. Left, right, clout. I decided to give my father lessons myself, to teach him to change step and to keep to the rhythm. We began to do exercises in front of our block. I would give the commands left, right, and my father would practice. Some of the prisoners began to laugh at us. Look at this little officer teaching the old chap to march. Hey, General, how many rations of bread does the old boy give you for this? But my father's progress was still inadequate, and blows continued to rain down on him. So you still can't march in step, you lazy old devil. These scenes were repeated for 2 weeks. We could not stand any more. We had to give in. When the day came, Franek burst into wild laughter. I knew it. I knew quite well I would win. Better late than never. And because you've made me wait, that's going to cost you a ration of bread. A ration of bread for one of my pals, a famous dentist from Warsaw, so that he can take your crown out. What? My ration of bread so that you can have my crown? Franek grinned. What would you like, then? Shall I break your teeth with my fist? That same evening in the lavatory, the dentist from Warsaw pulled out my crowned tooth with the aid of a rusty spoon. Franek grew kinder. Occasionally, he even gave me extra soup. But that did not last long. A fortnight later, all the Poles were transferred to another camp. I had lost my crown for nothing. A few days before the Poles left, I had a new experience. It was a Sunday morning. Our unit did not need to go to work that day. But all the same, Idyek would not hear of our staying in the camp. We had to go to the warehouse. This sudden enthusiasm for work left us stunned. At the warehouse, Idyek handed us over to Franek, saying, "Do what you like, but do something. If not, you'll hear from me." And he disappeared. We did not know what to do. Tired of squatting down, we each in turn went for a walk through the warehouse, looking for a bit of bread some civilian might have left behind. When I came to the back of the building, I heard a noise coming from a little room next door. I went up and saw Idyek with a young Polish girl, half naked, on a mattress. Then I understood why Idyek had refused to let us stay in the camp, moving 100 prisoners so that he could lie with a girl. It struck me as so funny that I burst out laughing. Idyek leaped up, turned around, and saw me while the girl tried to cover up her breasts. I wanted to run away, but my legs were glued to the ground. Idyek seized me by the throat. Speaking in a low voice, he said, "You wait and see, kid. You'll soon find out what leaving your work's going to cost you. You're going to pay for this pretty soon. And now, go back to your place." Half an hour before work usually ended, the capo collected together the whole unit. Roll call. Nobody knew what had happened. Roll call at this time of day? Here? But I knew. The capo gave a short speech. "An ordinary prisoner has no right to meddle in other people's affairs. One of you does not seem to have understood this. I'm obliged, therefore, to make it very clear to him once and for all." I felt the sweat run down my back. "A7713. I came forward. "A box," he ordered. They brought him a box. "Lie down on it, on your stomach." I obeyed. Then I was aware of nothing but the strokes of the whip. "One, two," he counted. He took his time between each stroke. Only the first ones really hurt me. I could hear him counting. 10, 11. His voice was calm and reached me as through a thick wall. 23. Two more, I thought, half conscious. The capo waited. 24. 25. It was over. But I did not realize it, for I had fainted. I felt myself come round as a bucket of cold water was thrown over me. I was still lying on the box. I could just vaguely make out the wet ground surrounding me. Then I heard someone cry out. It must have been the capo. I began to distinguish the words he was shouting. "Get up!" I probably made some movement to raise myself because I felt myself falling back onto the box. How I longed to get up. "Get up!" he yelled more loudly. If only I could have answered him at least. If only I could have told him that I could not move. But I could not manage to open my lips. At Idyek's command, two prisoners lifted me up and led me in front of him. "Look me in the eye." I looked at him without seeing him. I was thinking of my father. He must have suffered more than I did. "Listen to me, you bastard," said Idyek coldly. "That's for your curiosity. You'll get 5 times more if you dare tell anyone what you saw. Understand?" I nodded my head once, 10 times. I nodded ceaselessly, as if my head had decided to say yes, without ever stopping.
This ends side 2 of cassette 1 of Night. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 2.